This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Contemporary fiction in recent years has taken something of an apocalyptic turn. Books that would have been categorized once as science fiction are being recognized as part of the mainstream of literature right now. And that trend has affected even a writer like Louise Erdrich, whose books, although they're certainly diverse, have predominantly been historical or contemporary. Erdrich's new book, just out this fall, is called The Future Home of the Living God. It follows the lives of a group of Ojibwe Indians who are living in rural Minnesota. Louise, you've said that storytelling for you is a kind of addiction almost. When did that addiction begin?
It really began when my other addictions failed, you know. And I started understanding that I could have addictions that didn't give me really a hangover or, you know, were actually addictions that helped me in life. And the only problem was I was still smoking when I started writing. And so I believed for a long time that I couldn't write without a cigarette. And it was hard to break that one.
So you're not kidding around in a way, that there's some relationship between writing, storytelling, and less valuable kinds of addiction?
Oh, I'm not kidding at all. You know, it took hold in my 20s. I was searching for it. You know, I wanted something that would be powerful enough to keep me interested. I must have a short attention span because I was writing poetry and had to tie myself into my chair to finish my first piece of narrative. I had scarves. I had beautiful romantic scarves. And I didn't just use a rope.
Well, when you started to write, I wonder, some writers rebel against the idea of being part of an identity literature, say Jewish American literature or African American literature. They want to be just part of American literature or just themselves. Did you have any sense that you wanted to be part of Native American literature as distinct from anything else?
No, I didn't. I didn't think about it. I didn't think about that at all, what it might mean. The only thing that crushed me about this was that I wanted to be invisible. I was extremely shy, and I still go through that sometimes. I wanted to just have the books. But as a Native American person, you can't do that. You know, you have to tell people who you are.
You have to establish beyond the book.
Well, you have to establish your tribal identity because there's so many people who write books that are ostensibly Native, but they're not Native American writers. And so you really have to tell where you're enrolled or where your family is, or, you know, you don't have to be enrolled. You could be a descendant, but you have to come from a community and a family and a background that's Native American. It's tribal.
So how did that play out? I remember very distinctly just a couple of years out of college reading your first novel, Love Medicine, a wonderful book, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award in 1984. I think you were probably just around 30 at that time.
I had my baby, Persia. She'd just been born. And I was pregnant again, and that book came out. And then the next year, when I had my second baby, The Bee Queen came out. It was insane. I don't know how that happened.
That's a lot of fertility all at
once. I don't know how that happened. Yeah, and I think, seeing as women are just coming out with everything, I just want to say that what happened was really impossible.
How do you mean?
I mean that I look back and I think I must have been really losing my mind most of the time, because you can't do that. And then it took 5 more years for me to write a book, and that was more doable. That would make a little more sense.
This book is really a departure in some sense. They're native characters grappling mm-hmm. with their culture and their families and their ups and downs of life, as many of your characters,
right.
they always have. But the story takes place in some indeterminate time in the future, in the midst of a ecological crisis and a political crisis, and there are food shortages and power outages, and the government is rounding up and detaining, of all things, pregnant women. And so, given the apocalyptic mood of our current politics, or at least some of us feel that way, the book feels timely in a terrible way. You started working on this, though, long before, like 16 years ago. How did this
long
book come
before.
To be?
So I started writing it long before, and the only nod to current events in it is Mother. Now, Mother is basically, she's a kind of scary, pseudo-motherly entrapment figure who seems immune to shut down computers and can just come on at any time, any screen at any time, right? Mother. She's Karen Pence. And my daughter and I have been following Karen Pence and Pence too, because, you know, that's the next lineup. We're like one chocolate cake clogged artery away from from Pence, or maybe it'll be the double scoop of ice cream and then conk, you know? So there we are.
I have to ask this, and maybe you'll reject the premise totally out of hand, but is it possible in terms of the way influence does or does not work, that there are echoes of The Handmaid's Tale, Margaret Atwood's great dystopian novel, in this book?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I hope it can be read in some ways as an homage, because, you know, I loved that book. When I started the book and I wrote the book, it wasn't the cultural touchstone that it is now. And also Children of Men. This owes a lot to Children of Men, that P.D. James novel.
Sure.
Yeah. And to Ursula Le Guin and Left Hand of Darkness, all kinds of books. You know, those were really the books I read as a teenager that got me very excited about literature. And
I think in the acknowledgments or the author's note, you mm-hmm. referred to it as having to be excavated from some old computer. What happened?
Well, I abandoned it because I just didn't think it was going to go anywhere. It was in one of those, I love those Jetson-looking computers. Do you remember the iMacs with the sort of round colored plastic backs?
Oh, those were beautiful.
I loved them. And so I didn't want to leave it behind.
So you left a novel in it.
For a long time. And then the iCube came out. You remember the iCube?
I do.
The Thunderbird of computers. It's a really nice computer. So then transferred it into the Cube. And then, you know, I thought, damn, it'll be safe in the Cube. But it wasn't. And so...
Whoa. You don't even think to print it out or put it on a disk or something? It's just sitting in a Cube?
A floppy disk? It was on floppy disks. It was on... I had floppy disks.
Okay, so you were all backed up. I'm just making
sure. I was
sure.
All backed up.
Now, Louise, the threats to the bodies of Native American women are just not a matter of dystopian fiction. As I understand it, American Indians are 2.5 times more likely to experience sexual assault crimes compared to other races, according to the DOJ, the Department of Justice.
Exactly.
Was that very much on your mind as you wrote this book?
It was more in my mind as I wrote The Roundhouse, but there is inevitably echoes in this book. most of those crimes are committed by non-natives, knowing that on reservation land, it's very hard to get the attention of the authorities because you have to go to federal authorities for this crime. You have to go to the FBI, and everyone's backed up. The jurisdictional issues are so arcane. So
So tribal courts don't have access to cases like that?
Tribal courts handle a lot, and that's what we're working toward. We want to be able to handle crimes that occur on reservation land, crimes of all sorts. Little by little, tribal court justice and autonomy has been eroded.
What are the odds of that reform ever coming?
Well, at this point in history, we don't even...
Before he was president, Donald Trump clashed repeatedly with Native Americans. One of the running fights was about casinos, and he saw those casinos on reservations as a threat to his own businesses, and he sued the government over them. He argued that he was being discriminated against. At one point, he said, if I remember right, "I think I might have more Indian blood in me than a lot of those so-called Indians that are trying to open up the reservations." He said that.
Excuse
the president
me.
Of the United States.
Just like, oh my God.
Well, there it is.
Yes, I know it is. It is there. And we're actually trying to, I mean, I am anyway, trying to keep somewhat of a low profile. I don't want Donald's attention. We don't want Donald's attention, you know? It's all bad attention.
Well, but it's inescapable, isn't it?
I hope he doesn't turn his attention on Native Americans.
Louise Erdrich, the author of Love Medicine and many other books, novels, poetry, and essays, and her new novel is called Future Home of the Living God.